What I'm going to do in this talk is give you some perspective on the possibility for measuring sine 2 theta 1 3, sine squared 2 theta 1 3. I'm not going to talk about astrophysical at all. And I'll bore you a little bit showing you detector details, show you pictures of events and so forth. I apologize for that. Now, essentially, we've heard in the first two talks, very nice overview, that essentially the solar neutrino problem is essentially resolved, the atmospheric problem is essentially resolved, although we still would like to be certain those are taus, but we're pretty confident they are. And we know theta 1, 2 and theta 2, 3 are fairly large, might even be maximal. And if theta 1, 3 is near the Chow limit, the future would be very bright. Then we would have a big angle, and everybody knows we would have a good shot looking for CP violation. If theta 1, 3 is much closer to zero, we wouldn't have any chance to see CP violation. And to some extent, then, many people feel the observation of this angle is one of the keys, if not the key, to the future of this field. So essentially, I'm talking mainly in this talk about nu sub mu to nu sub e. There are other possibilities I'll mention in a moment. So I basically follow here Bill Marciano, who's going to talk later this week. This is the matrix we've heard about before. Now, it turns out this is actually very complicated. Of course, there's not even any, I haven't put any matter effects in, there are no matter effects in here, and so forth. And you could even have a large CP violation. Adam Parra likes to talk about the possibility this could be very complicated with CP violation. I'm going to ignore all of that in this talk. But it is interesting to note that there are, even if theta 1, 3 were zero, there still would be, this oscillation could still occur through theta 1, 2. So there are terms with theta 1, 2 in it, and some people feel it might be useful, in particular the Brookhaven group, might be useful actually to look for those kind of terms in a longer baseline. But essentially, I'm going to focus just on this first term. So there are these near future experiments, which I'll talk a little bit about, and spend a little time on Icarus, since most of you haven't heard too much about it, probably, or know too much about it. First, Minos, after the K2K results we heard about, will be able to confirm this and measure this parameter very well if it's not too small. The major goal to start with Icarus and OPERA is to prove conclusively, by doing an appearance experiment, that there are tau neutrinos. They do this in a different way. OPERA actually sees the taus. Icarus sees the electron decays of the taus. And then, but in both of these cases, Minos and Icarus will also be looking for nu sub mu to nu sub e. So my own guess is that Minos can do, and we heard something about this in a talk here earlier by Adam Parra, Minos can probably go to about 0.06, possibly better. And Icarus, in this first incarnation, where we just have the normal beam at CERN, about 0.03. To go below these values, we have to have either new generation of detectors, beams, or something like that. Now, the two beams that are being built at this moment, of course, the JHF is also going to be built, but the beam is not being built right now, is the NUMMI beam, which is 120 GeV protons in the main injector at Fermilab, and has several possibilities. It has this is the tunnel, basically. It has a space for a near detector, and I'll show you some pictures of that a little later in my talk. And that is actually turning on somewhere around 2005. The beam that people don't talk too much about in this country is the beam at CERN. So let me spend a few minutes about this. First, this beam starts with the SPS, which is 400 GeV. And essentially, we'll start out with a high-energy neutrino beam. So you basically can produce, with appearance, the tau neutrinos and then the tau itself. It's still on schedule for May 2005, in spite of the CERN problems, financial problems, because it was essentially largely paid for by Italy. And so it's essentially on schedule as before. Basically, this beam goes down into the morass, points to the Gran Sasso, and there really isn't any place for a near detector. So this is a somewhat different than the Fermilab situation, where you have a near detector, you can compare the near and the far detector. So that's why there's much more of an emphasis in this system on appearance experiments, where you don't require an ear detector, where you actually see something appear in the beam that was not there before. Now this beam actually also is a little bit less expensive than the Fermilab beam in the following sense. One had to connect the SPS to the LHC. So essentially the SPS beam has to be sent into the LHC collider so that you can have proton-proton collisions. However, this is not a very strenuous problem because the SPS is a very powerful machine and the LHC keeps in store for several hours. So every few hours, the SPS beam has to be directed into filling the LHC. During the period that it's not filling the LHC, it's essentially available for doing something else. And so the idea was, why don't we build a neutrino beam that points to the Gran Sasso? This tunnel here almost already pointed to the Gran Sasso. It was sort of miraculous. And so for a fairly small amount of money, when one was building the tunnel to connect the SPS to the LHC, one went on then to build this neutrino beam. It cost something like 80 million Swiss francs or something like that, which is a little cheaper than the Fermilab project because of this situation. The other thing is that this beam can operate for a very long time because essentially as long as the LHC operates, you need the SPS at CERN. And so to some extent, there's an unlimited amount of time for this to run because it's actually, the SPS is required for filling the LHC. So it has a long-term feature. Now, let me talk just briefly about some backgrounds before I talk about some detectors. There are essentially two kinds of backgrounds for observing this process. One background is the fact that neutrinos, and we heard this already from Ed's talk, there are already electron neutrinos in the beam. You have to distinguish these neutrinos from the neutrinos that come from the muon turning into the electron neutrino. And so essentially, what you want to do, roughly speaking, you would say, your sensitivity will be limited to being about the same value as this flux. And so you can go through, but you of course can make it much worse depending on the oscillation parameters and so forth. So very roughly speaking, this value is 0.4 to 0.8 for these two different beams times 10 to the minus 4 times 10 to the minus 2. So this, in some ways, is kind of a natural limit. To go below this limit for sine square 2 theta 1 3, you have to work very hard. To measure this flux very well, your detector, you're now essentially having a small signal on a big background. The second problem, which is probably more serious in some cases, is the neutral current problem. Neutral currents in some cases can look like electron neutrinos. If sine square 2 theta 1 3 was 5 times 10 minus 3, the neutral currents are approximately 100 times bigger. And so this thing is dying. So you either need some kind of a segmented detector or, as I will discuss in a moment, a liquid argon TPC. Now, how can we detect a very small sine squared 2 theta 1 3? Well, first there is the idea that I'm talking about now is to detect this value, this process, down to probably this level, possibly a little below this. You can also look for electron neutrino turning into muon neutrino. That's from a neutrino factory, and Steve Geer will talk about that. Or you can do something with supernova, which you'll hear about later. And roughly speaking, we can go probably 0.04, maybe a little lower for method one. The neutrino factory really will get you much lower values, maybe 10 to the minus 3, even lower. And it's conceivable, although we have to hear more about this, that in a supernova, because of the MSW effect, you might even go lower. So even if we don't find this in these beams, there are still future possibilities to go to much smaller value. Now let me spend a few minutes talking about the detector that also introduced the idea of a liquid argon TPC. We had a working group at Fermilab looking at detectors led by Debbie Harris. This is the group. And we actually came up with a report. The report was given to Mike Witherall. I don't know what he did with it. I hope he actually read it, but let's say at minimum. Because there's no R&D money. After we hoped this report would generate some R&D money. No R&D money has come because of this report. So anyway, so basically, probably the most important plot in this document is this plot showing the sensitivity for sine squared 2 theta 1 3, essentially to the distance that you go. You see there's a rather flat, this is using NUMMI beam, there's a rather flat curve. If all you want to do is just to measure this, distance is not such a serious issue because your flux is falling off like 1/distance squared, but your but there are other mitigating factors, and so this is a very broad minimum. But the more important thing is you see that some detectors, you can see the efficiency factor of some detectors. For example, this plots a 4.8 kiloton liquid argon detector and a 20 kiloton plastic detector. So you see right away that the plots are on the same place. And so this report sort of concluded that the liquid argon TPC, if it can be built in this way, is about 4 times better than these other methods. All of these methods are right now in discussion for the off-axis detector at for the NUMMI beam, which I'll discuss later.
That's a function of what beam?
This is the NUMMI beam.
Off-axis.
Yeah. Okay, let me spend a few minutes talking about the Icarus project, since we're making real progress. You may not have heard too much about this. This project is largely funded in Italy. In fact, right now we have 20 million euros for the next stage, plus some satellite groups like in Switzerland and the United States. Basic concept of this, without boring you, is it's a liquid argon TPC, or sometimes we call it a digitized bubble chamber-like process. We actually put a small liquid argon detector in front of the NOMAD detector in the CERN beam in 1995, 1996, and observe hundreds of events. This is an example of a quasi-elastic event. We heard about this earlier in Ed's talk, but you can see here clearly this is a muon. This muon actually went on into the NOMAD detector, and we measured its properties in the NOMAD detector, and here's a proton recoil. From these data, we've actually studied the properties and the sort of Fermi momentum distribution inside of liquid argon. It's of argon nuclei, excuse me. But it actually shows you the kind of information and tracking possibilities of a liquid argon TPC. We basically measure things in 3 dimensions, x, y, and time, which is the 3rd dimension. What? This track here would be about 5 centimeters maybe. But the track goes on into NOMAD. There's enough information to point it into NOMAD. After several years of R&D, we've now built a 600-ton detector, and we actually run the first 300-ton module in Pavia. This is very important because if you're going to build detectors in the future, let's say for the off-axis beam from Fermilab, the question will be, do you have to go very deep underground, which could be very expensive, or can you stay on the surface? And so this is sort of an important test of whether you can actually run things on the surface. But for us, it was just a test of whether we can build a large-scale liquid argon device. We ran the 300-ton detector for about a month, about 2 months actually, but maybe we get 1 month of good data. We had 30,000 triggers. These were cosmic ray triggers, so they're not the cleanest of all possible events that you want to see. This simply shows you the internal structure of the event. Here's what it looks like in the hall in Pavia. It's about 4 meters by 20 meters. So the events I will show you, is sort of displayed over a system that's 20 meters long by 4 meters by 4 meters. As I said, we read out in 3 dimensions. And so we can see where the event is inside this 4 meter by 4 meter by 20 meter volume. This is the readout electronics on top of the detector. And this is what it looks like on the inside. We basically drift the electrons over 1.5 meters. We then read out X and Y information. And as I said a moment ago, the time information is Z. So this actually gives you a 3-dimensional image. And here's some of our events. Now, for example, this is 20 meters by 4 meters. And you can see first, this is sitting on the surface of Pavia, and it's actually very quiet. We were actually very surprised by how quiet this is. So it basically has led us to believe we could actually build such detectors on the surface for the NUMMI off-axis beam. Here's an example of an electron shower. Here I blow it up for you. You can see what electromagnetic shower looks like. Here's a stopping muon. You can see what a stopping muon looks like. So to some extent, this has fulfilled the promise. This is not just a small device. This is 300 tons of liquid argon. We've now analyzed a lot of events. I won't bore you with the details, but we're now reconstructing these events. Here's a fully reconstructed K-plus decay. Which we reconstruct in 3 dimensions, and we've reconstructed many such events basically using the NOMAD algorithms for reconstruction. is a starting point. Now, what would an electron neutrino event look like in this detector? This is a simulation, of course. This is what the electron would look like. Now, I just put on here for you this picture I showed you a moment ago. So the remarkable, our simulation seemed to work remarkably well. So why is it we can do a very good job in identifying electrons? Because we track this vertex right, we track this event right to the vertex there, down to millimeters. If this were to be a photon conversion, the probability of a photon converting in such a small distance is very small. So this detector has one great virtue. It is extremely sensitive to extremely strong rejection of neutral current backgrounds, extremely sensitive to electron neutrinos. We were just approved in February to move the first 600-ton detector to the ground saucer. There has been some issues of safety. The safety issue is largely the fact that there are tunnels going through the ground saucer, which have people driving by, and if there were to be a large liquid argon spill, it could be dangerous. But and so we will spend about 6 months going through various safety committees, and so we've just now been approved. This will now go in Hall B, which used to house macro. The first 600-ton detector, which is finished now, will be traveling to the Gran Sasso. Basically, what happens is we take it apart. These two pieces come apart. This is then put on a truck and is then driven all through all the tunnels between Pavia and the Gran Sasso, driven into the hall, and backed in to Hall B, like that. The other two units, which this one is now funded, of the 12, there will be two more units in this first stage, a 1,200 unit and another 1,200 unit. These will also be in 600-ton units, and they will do the same way. These are going to be built in industry by Air Liquide in general. And essentially, this, we've actually built this mainly by physicists, but these will now be industrially produced. At least that's the plan. Okay, so that essentially tells you something about liquid argon detectors. So let me go back now to my general discussion. In the near future, we have these two beams. We have, I just showed you something about the NUMMI beam and something about the CNGS beam to the Gran Sasso. They go about 700 kilometers, and they're both going to be finished around 2005. And we hope Icarus will be taking data somewhere around 2006. Minos will be taking data around 2005, so there will be several years of this data that will be coming in. And I said you'll be able to go to sine squared 2 theta 1 3 around 0.03 in this region during that period of time. The next step, I'm just guessing 2010, the JHF people will say 2008. The next step then would involve four possibilities. There is the JHF beam going to Super K. We heard already this would be called Super K3, I guess. And that beam, as I understand, is probably 2008. And that's about 250 kilometers. There's a low energy option for the CERN situation, which I'll talk about in a second. We actually can rebuild that beam to emphasize lower energies and make it more sensitive to sine squared 2 theta 1 3. There is the off-axis beam to Canada, which I'll spend more time on. And finally, there's a possibility of a beam going from Brookhaven to the National Underground Laboratory, which I think Bill Marciano will talk more about, so I won't say much about that. Essentially, at this moment, as these beams turn on, this will actually be what we would call a super beam, because the JHF is a very powerful accelerator. These three options right now would not be super beams, although all of them could be upgraded to super beams. For example, there are ideas at CERN to upgrade the PS and the SPS to the status of the superbeam, the new injector and so forth. There's a possibility at Fermilab of improving the proton driver, and there's a plan at Brookhaven for improving that. So in fact, all of these could become superbeams in time. This is the only approved superbeam, however. Now, it's possible to put in new horns at CERN, improve the intensity only a little bit. In other words, to optimize the low energy region, largely studied by Andre Rubia and his colleagues in Zurich. And you see that you actually could do much better than I've showed you before, maybe 0.01, maybe 0.015 or something like that. So this could well be the long-term future at CERN, because there'll be at some point we will have declared that we've seen tau neutrinos, which I think we will see almost certainly. And this could, but Icarus, and by the way, Icarus can also go to 5 kilotons or 6 kilotons on Hall B. Right now it's only planned to be 3 kilotons. So in other words, there's a possibility for CERN to keep operating, to run in a different mode and actually push down, but they would probably never reach the region where you have the JHF plus super K. So CERN can make progress. The virtue, of course, is that you have these very nice events I showed you pictures of, and those events have a very clean signature, and that will be compared with what you can do with the super K. At Brookhaven, as you'll hear from Bill Marciano, there's a somewhat, this is from this person's talk at the one of the meetings, they have a somewhat more ambitious program to actually shoot a beam from Brookhaven to the underground laboratory. They're talking about a 1/2 megaton detector to some underground laboratory. And the virtue of this whole thing would be that if somehow science, somehow this mass difference was smaller than we thought, let's say, much smaller than we thought, they would be optimized for that. Whereas if otherwise, these other detectors do a better job. For example, the Neumann factors I'm about to discuss, or the Icarus and so forth. So to some extent, if somehow we would discover this mass difference is much smaller than we currently think it is, then this would have some relevance.
Why does their sensitivity actually get worse if delta n squared gets bigger?
This has something to do with the fact that they're also using the theta 1-2 process. In other words, actually the interference, those other terms, and what you better ask Bill this question, but it has something to do with the fact they're actually looking at interference between these processes. So there would be a signal here even if theta 1-3 was zero, but not necessarily at that level. That's the strength of their argument. Okay, now let me spend the rest of my time talking about this the possibility of a off-axis detector at Fermilab. I already talked about the detector part of this, which was the study at Fermilab. Now let me talk about the beam and the collaboration and so forth. So there is these are now transparencies from Adam Parra, who is the coordinator of this group. We had our first meeting over a year ago. We call it the NUMMI off-axis. A letter of intent has been submitted to Fermilab. These institutions joined, the ones without lines. We had a meeting at SLAC in January, and other institutions seem to be joining. So this seems to be getting very popular in terms of institutions joining, and hope would be a very important aspect of the future Fermilab, in my own personal opinion. The Princeton and the UCLA groups are sort of designated to help look at the liquid argon option here. So I'll talk a little bit more about that following on what I talked about Icarus. But there are other options which people are looking at as well for the detector. Now this is the current configuration of the NUMMI beam to the Sudan. Now Sudan, of course, is underground. I've told you there's a good chance now that we'll be able to build these detectors on the surface, especially something like liquid argon, which has this wonderful 3D track information, which has a lot of background rejection. It is possible to actually shoot this beam. This beam continues on. It continues, if it actually leaves the surface of the Earth somewhere here. But if you're talking about an off-axis beam, the off-axis beam leaves the surface somewhere else. So the off-axis beam can actually leave the surface somewhere around 1,000 kilometers from Fermilab. So you actually have the possibility of going about 1,000 kilometers, and that would be in Canada. There's some virtue to going to Canada because you would have possibly some Canadian funding help you. At least that's what some people think. The off-axis beam actually turns out to be an old idea, which was an early Brookhaven proposal. My friend Al Mann and others many years ago. But the virtue of this beam is that it's sort of something like, not exactly, a Jacobian peak-like structure. As you go off axis, you have more and more narrow energy range. And this narrow energy range, being at low energy, optimizes the neutrino oscillation length for let's say, NUSA mu to NUSA d. It also helps you reduce background in your detector because you now have a narrow energy range, allows you to reduce some of that neutral current background I told you, which is a serious problem. So one reason, now, the other reason, of course, now is that if you really want to go 1,000 kilometers, you felt that was important, you're almost forced to go off-axis, because that's where the off-axis beam comes out of the Earth. So there are different discussions about where, how far off-axis you will go, 5 kilometer, 10 kilometers, this is probably the preferred region here, and you see the beam now, on average, about 2 GeV. This is still a little higher energy than the beam you will have from JHF to Super K. And that may be one reason why the water detectors are a little less favored now. And but the point is that even when you go off axis, you still get a healthy event rate, as shown here. So this now looks like the preferred method to do this. Furthermore, Super K will be off axis to the JHF beam. So all future experiments have off axis detectors. Either Super K, either JHF to Super K or Hyper K, or in the NUMMI case. Now, in the NUMMI case, there are a host of different detector concepts. The initial goal is a 20 kiloton fiducial volume. Of course, our group is looking hard at a liquid argon, which I will tell you about. But there are other possibilities, having to do with things called RPCs, which I won't bore you with, drift tubes, or scintillators. So there are at least 3 or 4 options within this low Z option. And then there's this option, which I will talk about a little bit more, which is really a scale-up version of Icarus. That's why I told you about Icarus, because many people feel this is a very promising option if we can actually bring it in at some realistic cost and actually solve the technical problems. Now let me just go through one set of numbers for you so you get some idea of what we're dealing with here. At the first meeting, we presented a 5 kiloton detector option for liquid argon. This was the meeting last year. And here just gives you some idea. Over 4 years of running at 5 kilotons, that's essentially 20 kiloton years, you would have collected 60 of these electron neutrino events in the detector total. And you would have, in the case of, let's say, sine squared 2 theta 1 3, 0.03 or 0.01, you see, you would detect 44. So you see, at this level, the signal and background are comparable. By the time you get down to 0.003, you see, the background is very large and the signal is very small. So this is only 5 kilotons running for 4 years. If you had 20 kilotons running for 4 years, you almost certainly could get down somewhere into this region. But that gives you some idea of the kind of thing you're fighting. To go much below this number here, you don't have a chance. And so this method is sort of limited to 0.005, 0.003, or something like that. And here's the detector. The first detector we proposed, the liquid argon detector. Now, this looks quite different from Icarus because the idea now, which the Princeton UCLA group are looking at, is to have the detector all in one large volume. There's sort of an economy of scale in this way. And to some extent, since we're going to put it on the surface in a remote area, the safety problem has been mitigated. So that's probably one of the virtues of this. Furthermore, I showed you events in Pavia on the surface for the liquid argon, where the background was not overwhelming from cosmic rays. Of course, these are much bigger detectors, so we think we can actually build one of these detectors on the surface, and we can get the economy of scale because we put it all in one unit. Furthermore, we'll probably drift over 5 meters. This reduces the electronics enormously, and so those are the arguments we're making. Well, let me come back to that in a moment. I will say something about that in a moment. Okay, so this was actually something Adam Parr was here and gave a talk. This is sort of, and I would say this is in part mainly Adam's vision, but it's also all of us like this idea, that there would basically be a phase one of this system, which would be this 20 kilotons. We've decided now we will work on the design of a 20 kiloton detector rather than a 5 kiloton detector for phase one. And that would be running, you know, extremely optimistically, 2007. More likely 2010. And anyway, this first phase, you could go down to about 5 × 10⁻³. And in some cases, if you're extremely lucky, there might even be a CP violation effect, if the effect is very large and so forth. So you definitely would go from neutrino to antineutrino. Furthermore, you want to, there may be a way also to use the matter effects to look at the hierarchy problems of Vernon-Barger, the number of people shown. So this first phase actually sort of follows on what you've done with Icarus and Minos, and also in some ways is very competitive with JHF to Super K. Phase two is a much bigger deal. This is really aimed at probably seeing CP violation if you think it could be there at the level you can see. Now this breaks with tradition a little bit, because usually we think we should go 2,000 or 3,000 kilometers to look for CP violation. Here, you have to be rather lucky to see CP violation, but we cannot rule this out. Furthermore, you wouldn't go to phase two unless you measured sine squared 2 theta 1 3 to be relatively large, probably, because the funding wouldn't be there. Nevertheless, I think it's very nice for Fermilab to have a two-phase program which enters into their thinking in terms of the long-term future. That's one reason we help with this project. Now let me sort of, which time I have, I'm almost finished my talk, I think. Let me just spend a few minutes talking about the liquid argon option following Kirk McDonald's work. He has actually worked rather closely with Chicago Bridge and Iron, some people there, to look at what the Dewar would cost, what the and with other companies, what the electronics would cost, and also with us in the Icarus team, to go through a sort of set of numbers, ballpark numbers, to see what it would cost to build this great big device, this 100 kiloton thing, which we said was phase two. And we said we would budget, according to the Fermilab scenario, $500 million for this second phase. So what does this include? Well, it turns out that there are a large number of liquid methane storage tanks in the world. It's rather remarkable how many of these are. In fact, there's quite a few of these in Italy. These things are extremely safe. Some of these have been built by Chicago Bridge and Iron. Here's an example of these. They are cryogenic devices. Essentially, to our knowledge, none has ever broken or leaked or exploded. But you see, and some of these are much bigger than we're talking about, but they basically tell you this is a very mature technology building the liquefied natural gas systems. In fact, there's going to be, I think, a new one built in Baja, Mexico. Wherever you have natural gas coming in, you want to store this stuff. There are also very large tankers, very large ships that go around the world full of this stuff. So this is a very similar to the kind of Dewar you would build for liquid argon. And the Chicago Bridge and Iron people were very confident that these detectors do not explode, do not break, do not leak. Of course, you x-ray the wells, you do all kinds of things with these devices to be certain that they would not have a fatal flaw, but once you've done all those things, to our knowledge, none of these things have ever really failed, and there are quite a few of them in the world. So this is, as Kirk says, mature, low-cost technology, which we can actually appropriate in some ways. And that's why we're working with Chicago Bridge and Iron, which is one of the leaders in this. One of the problems, of course, is the cost of this. It turns out, to fill such a detector, you have to sort of fill it day and night. You bring up trucks of liquid argon and dump it in there. You have to do this day and night for a year. So 100 kilotons of liquid argon deliver one trailer load every 2 hours from Chicago. So forth and so on. So also, this is not cheap. Liquid argon is cheap, but once you get 100 kilotons of it, that's no longer cheap. So it's $0.8 million per kiloton. So that's one of the significant costs of this detector, is actually the liquid argon itself. Yes?
What's the biohazard of
it? If it's on the surface in Canada, very little. If it's underground in the Gran Sasso and their cars going by, very large, because it basically replaces the air people cannot breathe. Also, we did a study of the Gran Sasso. If we were to dump 5 kilotons of liquid argon in the Gran Sasso hall, it freezes the hall and the hall caves in. So it's extremely dangerous in many ways underground, because not because it blows up or toxic, but because it actually does bad things to your structures, and also it makes it impossible to breathe. But this is why we like the idea of a big tank on the surface in Canada, 1,000 kilometers away, with nobody around. Well, in this particular area, there's very little. Anyway, so Kirk also estimated the cost. Now, this Kaon is building our electronics for Icarus, and this, of course, may come down in time, but this is a probably realistic estimate. And then, of course, these are the other numbers where he shows in this transparency that you can actually do this on the surface. You could do it in the surface for two reasons. First, because I said in Pavia we saw very little background in the aqueous module. Secondly, the neutrino beam coming to you is pulsed. So you only have to have your detector operating for a very short period of time. This detector would not be useful for proton decay and things like that because it would be flooded with background. But for something like this neutrino beam coming there, the background should be manageable. So here's like a sort of like a sketch of a 200 kiloton cryogenic tank. Now this we believe is certainly is very good for phase two of this off-axis thing. In other words, you've actually measured sine squared 2 theta 1 3, and you want to do CP violation, things like that. Whether this will win the competition for phase one is not entirely clear to me because it depends on the timing, because if once Icarus runs and everybody feels it's a good technology, that may be true, but right now Icarus is still not a fully mature device, and so there's still a lot of discussion of other possibilities. Now, Kirk has also made an estimate of the cost, and this will answer at least in part of your question. These things do not scale in a simple way. First place, we're drifting over very large distances. It doesn't scale like the volume or like the surface. As you drift over large distances, you have much less electronics, which saves a lot of money, and so forth. So anyway, here's Kirk's scaling law. We've actually checked this out ourselves for the 5 kilotons. This answers your question. We did a detailed study of the 5 kilotons, putting all the numbers essentially from Icarus, and we got $26 million. So we sort of checked one point on this curve. A 20 kiloton detector, according to Kirk's number, would be about $60 million. And so this would be phase one. So this is our proposal for phase one of the off-axis. And of course, I showed you, of course, the 100 ton is the vicinity, 100 kiloton is the vicinity of $200 million. I think I'm essentially out of time. Let me just mention two more things. First, some of us have proposed a small, very small detector to get started, and we have meetings on this now. We had a meeting in Slack a few weeks ago. We have another meeting in Fermilab. The idea of this is to actually try to measure the electron neutrino contamination for the first time. Now, there is some question about the electron neutrino flux dead on at large angles and things like that. Then there's also the issue that Ed pointed out, extrapolating this to the detector. None of these things are trivial, but certainly one can start. So we actually debated whether we should put a little detector on axis or off axis or move it back and forth. But anyway, what we're proposing now...
Putting it where?
In the new Meniere Hall. I'll show you a picture. So we're actually proposing to build a small detector, 40 tons, and this would be, actually would be closer, would be pushed up close to, now this is the Minos near detector. It's a very nice detector, and it's magnetized iron, so if you move this up close by, you have a muon detector for this detector. And we presented this idea first at the Slack meeting in January. We have another meeting, it's a dedicated meeting to this detector, April 11th and 12th. Then the next off-axis general meeting for the whole group is Argon, April 25 through 27. Anyway, this actually would then allow us also to learn some of the liquid argon technology in the United States, which is now largely confined to Europe, where most of the funding has come from. So there's some enthusiasm for this, but we still have to look at the scientific. Now, let me just finish up before I summarize. It may not be enough, as has been pointed out to me here, to just, let's say we're going to have at least one long baseline beam we know, JHF to super K. That, as I said already, is a super beam, and it's funded because super K is built and JHF is being built, and certainly the neutrino beam will be built. But it turns out that may not solve the hierarchy problem. We already heard some talks here, because that distance is too short for the real matter effects. So now if sine squared 2 theta 1 3 is not zero, not real small, and let's say somebody finally finds that, then another virtue is, then I think one could argue, we really should have two locations, NUMMI and Japan, because in NUMMI we go through, let's say, 1,000 kilometers of matter. So now you want to compare neutrinos and antineutrinos, and so following this work, this basically shows you could, with some luck, I guess, measure the hierarchy problem. But the point is, I think there's an argument to be made, the Fermilab program should go ahead on the basis of the fact that JHF, although the director of Fermilab doesn't exactly buy this idea, the fact that JHF is a little too close to the super K to get really adequate matter effects, and if, of course, if sine squared 2 theta 1 3 is large enough, then the NUMMI site allows you to have these matter effects, and the combination of the two allows you to solve the hierarchy problem. So So I think there's a good argument to be made that we have should have two off-axis detectors, one in Japan, one in the United States, at different distances, and we even make some argument to have different detectors because they would complement each other. Okay, so let me summarize my talk. The progress of this possible observation of this will follow this way. Between 2005 and 2008, there is a chance to observe this if it's relatively large. I should point out that even though Icarus in this first phase has largely begun looking for tau neutrinos, it's always sensitive to these electron neutrinos. And we actually have a way to separate the electron neutrino events from the tau neutrino events because the tau neutrino electrons are somewhat kicked out of the plane because there's a recoiling neutrino. So in our FITs, we show that you can actually separate these two effects. So somehow, during this period, we may go down to 0.03 and may even be lucky and discover the effect. So we should never ignore the possibility that we could find the thing very near the Cho limit, which would be fantastic, and these experiments would confirm this over a very short period of time. So we might know by 2008 that this effect is pretty large, then we could really start a major set of planning for the next step. If we're not that lucky, between 2008 and 2012, one or more of these things will happen. This will certainly happen. There's a good chance that there will be a new horn system put into the CERN system, which extends this range a little bit for Icarus. Maybe even Icarus will be increased in size. And then maybe, if we're lucky, we can get this initial NUMMI off-axis beam. This will allow us then to search down to about 0.05. Generally, it's considered if we want to go below 0.05, we need something like hyper-K at the JHF. That's, you really need a much bigger detector because you're really hitting the background limits and now you're hitting the statistical problems. On the other hand, it's my own gut feeling, if we don't measure something in these two phases, these other projects may not actually ever get approved. They might for other reasons. Now, furthermore, if we don't see sine squared 2 theta 1 3 in these two ways, future CP violation search will probably be harder to sell. The neutrino factory will be harder. You'll hear that from Steve Geer. And so my conclusion is this observation is crucial. Thank you.
Good time. We'll finish with 2 minutes for questions.
That's fine.
Sergey?
Yeah, I had that on my plot. There was actually talk here about that. And let me just try to paraphrase this talk as simply as I can. If you could actually, you could do something better than Cho, if you could reduce the systematic errors in reactors down to about 0.8%, and if you had two detectors. Systematic errors this small are very hard to come by, but they might happen. And so in that case, you could probably go to 0.02. So reactors in principle look like they could go down to about 0.02. That's at least the numbers I heard. If the systematic errors are at the level that you got in Bouguer, which were 2%, then you can't go below 0.06 or something like that. So reactors still have a region. They're comparable to the region that Icarus and Minos would cover, possibly in the same time, but they're not a appearance experiment in some ways. And so you may have a little harder time convincing yourself that the systematic error is really that small. But I think reactors could play a role in that region. I don't think they can ever go below 0.02.